Welcome to Preaching Podcasts for Those Who Proclaim Publicly, a weekly podcast from the Stevenson School of Ministry where we take a look at the lectionary from diverse and unique perspectives so that we may better contribute to preparation for church leaders in Sunday worship. I'm your host, Deirdre Good, and with me today is Josh Davis and Althea Spencer Miller. Please introduce yourselves.
I'm Josh Davis. I am the Dean of the Alabama Integrative Ministry School and the professor of or instructor of theology and ethics at the Stevenson School for Ministry.
And I am Althea Spencer Miller, and I teach at Drew University Theological School in the area of New Testament and early Christianity.
Thank you. So today we're going to be looking at readings from what's called in our lectionary Sunday of the Passion and also Palm Sunday. So, Josh, are you going to say something about these elements of today's lectionary choices?
It's just a little bit of historical context for what's going on here with these readings. This is a very strange rite in many ways. It is the Sunday of the Passion. It is how it reads in the prayer book, the Sunday of the Passion, : Palm Sunday. And this is sort of a jarring rite in many ways, because the service begins with palms, a palm procession, which is receiving Jesus as a messianic king as he enters into Jerusalem. And most of the time, these procession will take place outside of the church, sometimes moves into the church and then around the church. But when it begins outside the church, oftentimes it will end at the threshold of the church. And as you move in, you begin to focus on a liturgy that's focused on specifically the Passion of Christ. The reason for this is twofold. At some point in Christian history, there was a separation between the celebration of Easter as a focus on the resurrection of Jesus and the celebration of the Passion or the crucifixion of Jesus on the Sunday prior to Easter Sunday. That's why we have this Passion Sunday. But also, there was in and around Jerusalem a practice of having a palm procession that would move from Bethany into Jerusalem. And this became a part of many Christian worship services, especially prior to the 1979 revision of the prayer book that were eventually included. And these two aspects of this Sunday were brought together. And they're both reflected in this one Sunday rite. And it's important to note, I think, this historical background, just so that we know exactly what's going on, but also to note that it's strange. It frames the week in an unusual way, because you have this, that is, the week that follows, Holy Week. It frames it in an unusual way, because we have a Jesus' entry into Jerusalem, then we go immediately to his crucifixion and death. Then we move into Holy Week, where we sort of back up a little bit and look at the details and have his crucifixion again and then his resurrection. And it's just worth noting the explanation as to why that's the case, but also noting in a pastoral way that this can be a jarring experience. This particular Sunday can be jarring for parishioners, for worshipers, and also to remind ourselves of the way in which this is the whole experience of the week that follows, framed as it is by the death of this one whom we've just celebrated, our reception of him. It can draw up and draw up many memories and issues for many people to be aware of in the service.
Great.
I was listening as Josh explained and brought to our attention this contrastive juxtapositioning of the Palm Sunday, which is a celebratory or at least an acclamation, a narrative of acclamation, right alongside a narrative of torture and death. And it really is an odd kind of juxtapositioning. and a jarring one. And it reminded me of a proverb that we have in Jamaica. I'll say it in Jamaican first, and then I'll translate it into standard English. Chicken marry out an ear. And it's when the chickens are merry, there is a hawk nearby. And so the chickens, instead of doing their usual quiet picking around in the ground for worms or whatever it is, they're actually now running around in a way that looks quite excited. And it's a sign, according to this proverb, that there is trouble nearby. And while it may not be an exact map, there is a sense in which you have this acclamation happening in the liturgy of the palms, with the palm narrative going on. Blessed is the king who comes in the name of the Lord, and glory in the highest heaven, as it is in Luke. And you get to realize that that could be happening in the presence, near or far, the presence of an imperial eye that is actually threatening in some way to these folk. And so the juxtaposition for persons who are subaltern, persons who are marginalized, groups that understand themselves as part of the underclass, you recognize that every celebration is attended by a sense of insecurity and threat and the possibility of termination. And that's what that juxtaposition brings to mind.
I think that's just wonderful, because it helps us to understand some of the tensions and difficulties that this text poses, and this particular rite poses on this day, in a way that encourages the worshipers to identify with those subaltern people, right? That you're talking about specifically, yeah. Because that's how you can make sense of that. That's how you can begin to make sense of this experience of very extreme shifts from one to the other, which can be very disruptive. But if you're, and this is also important, I think, because the instructions or the rubric for this particular day in the BCPs, I mean, the reading, the gospel reading about the palms is separate from the gospel reading that is a part of the liturgy of the word about which one would be preaching on this day. So I think it's very important to frame, and for preachers on this day to be aware of framing that the experience of the palms, how does this make sense in relationship to what is about to happen? And I think that what you've pointed out here, and I love that proverb, I'll never be able to say it in Jamaican, but I love that. And thank you for bringing it up, because I think it does provide a key for how to understand what's happening here.
Yes, it helps, I think.
So just to build on that, looking at the gospel in the liturgy of the Psalms, we can see that it could be read in two ways. And I'm looking at the story about Jesus on the point of entering Jerusalem. He's in Jericho with disciples. He's come to Bethphage and Bethany, and he's preparing the entry into Jerusalem. And you could read this whole passage by recognizing that Jesus is posing a threat to the imperial power, because, as the passage Althea quotes, blessed is the king, the basileus, who comes in the name of the Lord. So the acclamation that is done joyfully by the whole multitude of the disciples calls Jesus king, which of course is a title that compares to the Roman emperor. You could also say that in the passage when Jesus explains that he needs a conveyance to get into Jerusalem, you could untie a colt that has never been ridden and say, the Lord needs it. So this would be the use of the term kurios, capital L for Lord, the master, the one in power, needs of it. And it's repeated twice. So you could say this emphasizes Jesus' authority. But equally well, you could say that because Jesus doesn't ride a war horse and simply rides a donkey, that this isn't a kind of triumphal entry into Jerusalem. And Jesus doesn't enter into Jerusalem and do anything in the temple, which you could say would be a non-triumphal entry, because the end of an entry into Jerusalem would be an entry into the temple and doing something ritualistic in the temple. So you could view this narrative in from the underside, as well as the intimations of Jesus' own authority.
So as a direct confrontation with Rome on the one hand, but as something like a pantomime or something like that on the other?
Yes, absolutely. We've got to get in the Lucan narrative, we've got to get Jesus into Jerusalem because that's the focus. That's the focus of his great journey in the whole of the gospel and the journey that forms the whole community around him. It's not a journey for its own sake. It's not a map journey. It's a journey that, like the wanderings in the wilderness of the Israelites, it shapes a whole community around Jesus. And so the whole community is with Jesus as we enter into this place where the whole journey has its goal. So we have to get him there.
You know, the image that comes to mind, two actually. One is Martin Luther King leading that peace march in Selma, and I think persons were singing "We Shall Overcome," or the young folk in Tiananmen Square in China, marching against a heavily armed army, marching for justice and peace. And there's a sense in which just the fact of doing it sends a message. So even if it's in the pantomime, it's not necessarily devoid of political implications. It may just not be loud and in your face. Or if it's a provocation in which "Blessed is the King" is shouted loud enough for Roman legions to hear, there is an implicit provocation in this. And even if it's done peacefully and makes you wonder, when the Pharisees get anxious, what is it that they're anxious about in either setting, whether it's confrontation or sideshow.
Exactly. The fact that there's a loud enough crowd, the broad enough crowd to include the Pharisees in it, who say, "Order your disciples to stop." They give him an imperative, "Order your disciples to stop." So this leads us to, well, what are the Pharisees doing? This looks like an inhibitive command. But it's possible to read it not as a power play, but rather a protective action. I mean, if we just look at the way in which Pharisees are the prime dialogue partners of Jesus in Luke's gospel, in at least three occasions they invite him to have a meal with them, which is not a hostile act. In fact, it's the act that identifies Jesus as one who enjoys table fellowship, whose inclusive table involves all kinds of insiders and outsiders being present, and he is accused by detractors of being a friend to tax collectors and sinners in Luke's mm-hmm, gospel. Mm-hmm. In chapter 13, the Pharisees don't do anything other than say to Jesus, "Herod threatens your life, you need to leave right now." I think maybe we could see the Pharisees as trying to protect Jesus at this point in the narrative, even while they use imperatives. They're desperate.
Yeah. Which I think belies the any notion that this would just be an innocent, unimpactful kind of event. The Pharisees, yeah, if they need to protect Jesus, they are anxious about something.
It occurred to me that for the first time, as you were, when you began talking about, he doesn't ride in on a war horse, but he rides in on a donkey. It occurred to me for the first time, I'd never thought about it before, but that there may be a sense in which you could see Jesus's action as farcical, mm-hmm, almost like in a mocking way. especially of Roman processions and things. And looked at it from that, I have no idea whether that's a legitimate interpretation of what this event might have actually been, but it does add an additional element to, you know, if there's a kind of mockery of Rome's, you know, self-confidence and pomp and circumstance going on here. And if that could have been a possible interpretation of what Jesus and his disciples were doing, especially since he was so, you know, it's a lowly action on a donkey, right? And who is this man from Nazareth? You could see this as well as, you know, what are you doing? Look at what you're about to provoke, or, you know,
yeah,
let's not do this. Let's keep the peace, or something along those lines.
I like that. It almost sounds like a first century version of Saturday Night Live.
Right. And very much, you could see it in a Mel Brooks movie or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, parody. Parody.
A parody, yes. Yeah.
And look at his response to the Pharisees. If these crowds, if these acclaimers were silent, the stones would shout out. Mm-hmm. You know, as if this is a global response, not limited to human voice.
Yeah, and irrepressible.
Exactly.
Whatever those who spectate upon it might think about it, what is happening here is irrepressible, and that has to be provocative.
Right. And there's an interesting connection there too, because what first clicked when I began to think about that was I was thinking about the fool and King Lear, and in that, you know, the way the fool can get away with mocking Lear to his face in certain kinds of ways, and he does so by sort of taking on the actions of the king and things like that. But in that play, the nature itself responds to the things that are happening around. So another point of connection.
And if I might just put it into, some years ago, I don't remember the author, but a book in a scarcely attended to section of biblical studies, a book titled Humor in the Bible, explored all the places where there, not all, but a number of representative number of places where there is actually humor, and we tend to miss it, you know, and to even begin thinking about this as parody, that opens doors. I think that's a great idea.
I always try to point out to students that the Exodus story, the story of the plagues, you know, is not just a terrifying story. There's a lot of humor in it too, if you're paying attention to it. You know, Pharaoh is very silly in that story.
I was going to suggest that at the end of Jesus' line, these stones would shout out, what we could do is simply have an exclamation mark, and that would orient us to different ways of interpreting this.
Yeah. Right.
Instead of a period.
Yes.
You know, editors hate exclamation marks.
Shucks.
What? There's a one in a book of yours? No, 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 no. Let's go on to the other readings in the Liturgy of the Word.
I know this will get cut out, but I could have sworn I heard some stones barking in the background.
The dog had been silent too long.
Too long.
I was going to simply make a general introductory point about the narratives of the Last Supper, which is one of the two long gospel readings for Palm Sunday. Every time I look at any of the narratives of the last week of Jesus' life, the last days of Jesus' life, the last actions of Jesus' life, including the crucifixion, the thing that I look for is how the gospel writers portray the agency of Jesus, describe Jesus as commanding events, dictating events, leading events. Why do they do this? Because in a narrative where Jesus is the object of people's attention, never the subject of the narrative, the gospel writers are trying to overcome the shame, the humiliation, the ignominy of suffering and death by giving Jesus agency where they can. And you can see this in Luke 22, where the narrative starts off with the Passover meal, and Jesus is described as hosting the Passover meal. So in a narrative of the ancient world, it's the host who hosts the banquet, who invites everybody to the table, and then the host speaks, and that's what Jesus is doing in this Passover narrative. And the narrative, the speech at this point, describes what's going on and what will happen. I will suffer. I'm eating this with you now, but I will not eat again until something else has happened in the future. So all this agency opens the narrative of the Passover, the Last Supper.
And play it out some more, Deirdre, if you will, because there are different points in that Luke 22 through 23 narrative where that agency shows up.
The point, unfortunately, my version of the text doesn't have verses and so on. So
yeah,
let me just switch to something that has verses. In the middle of the Last Supper, there's an accusation that someone will hand him over. And they dispute amongst themselves. And he controls that disputation. In other words, he's trying to control the conversation, the symposium of, because Luke loves eating and meals and symposia in the Hellenistic world, and Jesus is now part of this. So he controls the dissension, because you are not lording over each other. So he's going to control that narrative and say, it's going to be service. The characteristic amongst you should be one of servitude one to another. Then he turns to Simon. He's now controlling the fate of Simon. I have prayed for you that your faith might not fail, and even when you turn back, you might strengthen your brothers. So he's predicting the future. He's acting as a prophet here. This is a prophet at the Passover, at the Last Supper, predicting what will happen. And then he's controlling the narrative of the arrest in Gethsemane. The one who has no sword must sell a cloak and buy one. Scripture is fulfilled. I will be counted amongst the lawless. They come out with two swords, and he says, okay, that's enough. When we get to the narrative of Gethsemane, he removes himself from the disciples and begins to pray. And praying shows him not in silence, not in reciprocal mode, not in passive mode, but rather initiating prayer. If you are willing, Father, remove this cup from me, yet not my will, but yours. And we see in most of the text of that narrative a description of what's in Greek called the agon, the great suffering of the hero. And you cannot have a hero without agon, without suffering. And so in this narrative of Gethsemane, Jesus prays more earnestly and his sweat becomes like great drops of blood falling on the ground. But he will never give in. You have agony, you have the hero, but the hero, however much the hero suffers, the hero can never gives up. Then the crowd comes and Judas identifies him. And immediately one of his followers takes a sword and strikes the ear of the slave of the high priest. And Jesus heals that ear. In other words, he can respond by reversing injury. So that's another example of his agency. And then he is seized and taken away. So that then he becomes less active. But these are elements of the agency of Jesus in Luke's passion narrative.
And that's striking to me too, because you know, you have in the various gospels, and you have this in Luke as well, there's this identification of Jesus with the past or with different sort of archetypal elements. Like you have him being identified with Israel, you know, in the earlier parts of the story and the birth narrative and things like this.
Yeah.
You have his baptism, where he emerges as an individual agent in his own right with a mission and message and ministry, and he's a prophet, right? And he's proclaiming the kingdom and things like this. But at just this moment in the narrative, and this is something that Hans Frey pointed out in his book, The Identity of Jesus Christ, that he becomes less identified with these larger components of the history or archetypal elements of the history of Israel, but in one respect, but becomes an agent, all the action now becomes about what's happening to him and what is he doing and how is he an agent in all of this. And I've always found that really striking, because the conclusion that Frey draws from that is, isn't it interesting that at just the moment where Jesus' story should be about everybody, right? It should become a kind of a mythological or an allegorical theme, especially if you think about that in relationship to the resurrection. You think about, you know, resurrection in a kind of thought of allegorically or mythologically is just, you know, it's like the movement of the seasons or the passage of, you know, we go from day to night and death to life or winter to spring, these kinds of things. And those connections, those natural connections are oftentimes made. But the Gospels don't make that move at that point. They become about how it goes with this man in this particular place and this particular time and how and his being killed. And I've always found that really striking. And is a point that's worth mentioning in relationship to what's happened with the procession of the palms as well, because it indicates that what matters here is his faithfulness to his mission. Because as you receive him with the procession of the palms, and now all of these forces now begin to sort of emerge and come into conflict with him and his mission and ministry in a very direct way. Those forces, in fact, begin to prevail, and as they begin to prevail in the garden and with. But he still remains an agent of that mission that's brought him to this point, all the way to the end, faithful to it even unto his crucifixion.
You know, as looking at what happened between chapter 19 and chapter 22. In chapter 19, we had been talking about the palm liturgy.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to highlight again that notion of parody and confrontation, mm-hmm. because in a sense, all of this agency. The potential or the abbreviated mythopoesis of the moment. There is a kind of confrontation that has happened in the Jesus narrative between Luke 19 and 22, where so much of Jesus's teaching is, if not against Jewish tradition, but against the ways in which representatives of the traditions have set up a system that and practiced that system in a way that it could now be toxic. So there's a kind of ongoing challenge in his teaching, in his critique, in his observations. There's a kind of ongoing challenge to a group of persons. And in chapter 20, it's the chief priests and scribes who come with the elders. So in a sense, they represent the tradition. But they come to him and they say, they demand of him, tell us by what authority are you doing these things? And he goes into this critical teaching mode for the rest of that chapter. And by the time you get to 22, Deirdre, I'm hearing the agency in terms of an ongoing assertion of a sense of rightness in the face of profound wrong that has brought Jesus and his disciples to an incredibly somber penultimate moment in his life that moves us indeed to the ultimate moment in in these gospel narratives, but that agency, that sobriety, that soberness of heart and mind and steadfastness of spirit under fire is an incredible model, especially in these times. I mean, if we start with the SNL, especially in these times when there is so much to advocate for, so much to resist, and so much to remember, perhaps as a time when there was some rightness within us, not altogether right, but some rightness that is now being sacrificed. And can the living of this hour, for those of us who are in this time, find a model, a template in that agency, in that steadfastness, in that sense of purpose, undeterred purpose that you're talking about in Jesus, and that is our salvific model.
There's a funny little element that's only in Luke. It comes up in Luke 23, verse 12, and it's at the point where Pilate has said to the crowd, I'm not finding any basis for an accusation, but they don't buy that. And they maintain that this is the crowd in Jerusalem, that he has stirred up people by teaching. And so Pilate learns, and Pilate deflects the desires of the Jerusalem crowd and sends him off to Herod. Mm-hmm. And the result of the sideways move of Pilate is that Pilate becomes less competent, less authoritative. Herod then seems very happy to see Jesus, but Jesus gives him no answer, so they really have nothing to say to each other. And then the chief priests of the Jerusalem crowd and the scribes of Jerusalem, you see, I'm stressing their location because this is not all chief priests and all scribes.
They accuse
Jesus, and Herod soldiers treat him with contempt, and then they put on Jesus an elegant robe, perhaps a purple robe, perhaps some kind of noble adornment, and they send him back to Pilate. And look at the next line. Yeah, this is the parody too, Josh. That same day, Herod and Pilate became friends with each other.
Yeah.
Before they had become enemies, they had been enemies. The point here being, I mean, I'm not 100% sure of how to read this, but I read this that the collusion between the squeamish Pilate and the avoidance of his authority and the, you know, affable Herod meet to collude together in an expression of friendship, which is an expression of support, confidence, loyalty, you know, absolutely crucial that in a court setting that you're surrounded by friends who in the courts of the Hellenistic period are courtiers, philoi. So that now Jesus' move towards death is surrounded by a collusion that never occurs in any other gospel between mm-hmm. Herod and Pilate.
And backslappers, right? all sort of, you know, sort of swooping in to, you know, to laugh at each other's jokes and take care of each other while this man who's been committed to liberating bringing sight to the blind and lifting up the poor is being mocked, right? Exactly. And that's what I find so interesting about the fact that the Gospels don't go to like some sort of general principle here, right? Yeah. Instead, they focus on the fact that he stays, he doesn't compromise. He stays with his commitment that what he's doing is right, that he is in fact enacting the good here on behalf of others. And I find that extraordinary. It's all about sort of recognizing the role that his agency has, despite the fact that these all of these forces, which are just everyday power forces, you know, bat slapping men, you know, and laughter and that kind of thing, taking care of each other. Those are the demonic forces that are at work here, which are gaining the upper hand. And yet he still remains faithful. And that becomes what Paul will say is justifying or the enactment of righteousness
Oh man, the potential for application in the present time of this passage just exploded exponentially.
Yes.
Excellent.
One last bit about that I would like to add that I've always really appreciated, and I, whenever I get the chance, I like to point people to read the Irish Dominican Herbert McCabe. He liked to describe what's happening here, and this should be a way of connecting it back to the jarring shift between the palms and the crucifixion. He liked to say that you know, we think about the cross, there is an element of failure in the cross that we have to recognize. You know, the one who, when John the Baptist says to him, "Are you the one who we are to expect?" and he says, "Well, look at what's happening. You know, let that speak." That all of a sudden, when he gets in Jerusalem, all of that momentum and all of these things that were happening that were signs of the dawning of the realm of God among human beings, some seem to come crashing to a halt as these men seem to triumph over that. And there's an element of failure in that. We see that in the disciples' response. We see that in all of these. And yet, he says that. But you have to recognize that this is not about, what's really going on here is not necessarily that they're winning, but that Jesus's desire for what he wants for the poor and the blind and for all of humanity is so much greater than what can be contained in just simply settling for something smaller than that. He says, and at one point he says, you know, if you want to learn how to pray, you know, learn how to want. Because this is exactly what we see in Jesus's cross, seeing Jesus's prayer as an expression of want, of desire, and to understand being faithful to that as what it is that's truly truly transformative, and in fact leads us on the path to resurrection. So there is an interruption, and there is a sense in which the powers swoop in and seem to take over. But Jesus never once stops and settles for something short of what he wanted for all along, even in spite of the fact that his continuing to remain faithful to that was what was going to get him killed. And I've always found that especially helpful in terms of giving us something other than just the fact that this sort of traditional idea, or that we oftentimes hear about the fact that, like, you know, Jesus dies in our place, right? We deserve to be killed, but Jesus is killed on our behalf. There's something else more profound and much more interesting going on here than that.
And I pick up very quickly the idea of the cross as failure. It reminds me of Judith Halberstam's book, The Queer Art of Failure, in which failure is reconceptualized not so much as an inability. It's not an inability to meet a norm that would measure success, but not having met that norm, you have the opportunity to redefine yourself in relation and over against those norms, and to produce ways of understanding, produce a lifestyle that can actually then stand as a critique of the norms that you have not met, and that you don't need to meet. So that you get to ask a question, what are the benefits of failure? What doors does failure open for us? And that goes right alongside of the resurrection. At least I'm putting it alongside of the resurrection, that the resurrection is not a resurrection to normativity, that it becomes a resurrection to an alternative narrative that transforms the ways in which those who who adhere to that narrative actually find themselves living in the society. A challenge.
Wonderful. I'm just looking at Jesus' words to the daughters of Jerusalem in 23:28. Do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. Which I think makes the point that Joshua and Althea are making as well. Thank you so much for this powerful and moving discussion about Luke's Passion narrative on Palm Sunday as we move into Holy Week and leading up to Easter. So we look forward to being together again, and I want to thank everybody who has joined us for this conversation and all of you who are listening to it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, and happy Holy Week.